You are. I can't hear a thing.
On purpose.
No. I didn't do it that time. I tried to unmute you, and you muted yourself at some point, I think.
First, you kill the applause, and then you. And that's good. So everybody couldn't hear me doing the applause. But how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing so good, RFM. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. Just coming back from St. George and the Thrive Conference over the weekend. That was a swell time.
I live in Southern Utah, the next city over in Washington. You came down to Southern Utah to go to Thrive. And I'm really sorry. I didn't see you. We had planned to grab a bite and maybe recorded something with Rebecca. I had all these plans with my wife for her birthday. We ended up going to Fish Lake, hung out in the hot springs there, went to the only bar in the Tri-County area, Bar 86. Folks, if you're up there in Monroe, Richfield, Utah, Bar 86, there was only four people in there, but my wife and I made number 5 and 6. We played a few games of pool, and I had a nice cold Coors Light.
Wow, you were living it up.
Oh, yeah. It's really happening up there in Monroe, Utah. Population of I think about 13, and we went to a restaurant for breakfast. It was voted the third best breakfast restaurant in the area, but I checked, there's only three restaurants in Monroe and Richfield that I think that make breakfast. So anyway, how's the life? Is good for you?
Yes, absolutely. I'm just a little bit behind on my project, so tomorrow I hope to be able to produce the Sunday school for this week, and also maybe Friday morning Shakespeare, getting back into that now that you got it put back up on YouTube.
Yeah, folks, if you have not checked out RFM's Brush Up Your Shakespeare, I'm telling you, even if you I've never really checked out Shakespeare, I know he's, you know, historical in terms of literature and plays, but RFM is getting such positive feedback. I was looking at the YouTube comments today. He is just doing phenomenal. And he's also doing the same thing with the Mormon Sunday School. So his episodes are by far, every single one of them, more viewed than mine. So I'm excited.
As far as Shakespeare goes, I'm voted number three best Shakespeare podcast on YouTube.
Look at that. And you just got started. And
there's three of them.
I bet by the time this is done, you're going to be number one.
I'm hoping so, with a bullet. Yeah.
Well, folks, we have a great show for you tonight. We're going to bring on our guest. We've got Dan Vogel and Bryce Blankennagel. And let me just share sort of when we went into the Sidney Rigdon, Solomon Spaulding theory. Several weeks ago, we did two parts, part one, part two of the theory. We showed a lot of the documentation around that theory. And there were certain things that were really interesting. The fact that Rigdon shows up with unclaimed letters at the Pittsburgh post office, for instance. There's the 1831 document that shows up before Eber D. Howe and Philastrus Hurlbut that showed that the folks were connecting Rigdon and Joseph Smith together with a Henry Rangdon, who appears to be a reference to Sidney Rigdon. And there were other things as well. And the theory I thought was more interesting than I expected it to be. I think RFM and I come down maybe a little differently. I'm sort of interested, but not convinced. And I think RFM is much more opposed to the theory being happening. Is that right, RFM? Am I fair in saying that?
I'm going to unmute myself since you muted me again. I'm on to your tricks, Mr. Real. No, I would say that this theory is so fringe and radical that it's going to require a lot more evidence to convince me that it's correct than I have seen.
Yeah. And so we brought Bryce Blankennagel, the host of the Naked Mormonism podcast, which I just think is phenomenal, Bryce. And I think most of the listeners to this show are going to know who you are, but maybe I'll give you just a second here to kind of say any opening thoughts that you've got about who you are and to share maybe any general comments about what we're going to go into tonight from your point of view. And then I'll give a few minutes to Dan.
Is this supposed to be timed at this point, Mr. Real?
I don't think these need to be timed, but let's not take too long. If you guys just introduce yourselves, the audience will know who you are. You guys are historians and scholars in Mormonism for quite a long time now. Oh, Bryce, I can't hear you, my friend. Sorry. There's a nice line in the show. You're muted.
It's just, all right. Dan's next. All right.
He's going crazy. He's muting everybody.
So, I mean, yeah, you summarized it really well. I host Naked Mormonism. I also do a current events called Glassbox Podcast. Consider myself a history communicator. I try and take the dense field of Mormon history academia and communicate it to lay audiences, make it accessible information to everybody available. My own personal research focuses more on psychedelics in early Mormonism, and that's kind of what I've published on. But the serialized history of Joseph Smith and the early church is the Naked Mormonism, and that is kind of what has led me to be invited onto this panel. And I am very excited to talk Spalding about this and just everything about it. This is a lot of fun.
Is it correct that Bryce, you once were an advocate of the Solomon Spalding theory?
That is correct. Well, I think both of you are probably quite familiar with the sense of this, that when you start studying it, it becomes a very appealing theory because it feels very parsimonious. And when I began studying Mormon history, it's one of the very first things that you run into when you're studying chronological history, because it's such an early event in the church, obviously. So as I studied it, I believed it and advocated for it. And I've since kind of moderated my position a bit to just kind of happily living in ambivalence and skepticism about whether or not it's true.
Love it. Dan, I'll turn some time over to you to introduce yourself to our audience. You're a familiar guest, and share any thoughts you've got.
Well, I'm definitely not an advocate of the Spalding theory. And I kind of feel like it's a phenomenon, but my position is that it diverted a lot of attention away from maybe better and more fruitful studies while we were chasing this like a red herring for 100 years. I really wish in the 19th century would have been spent pursuing what Joseph Smith was more like, what he studied, what he read, what he said when he was in Palmyra and Manchester. All of those would have been far more helpful than just money digging stories. We should know a lot more, but it got diverted for 100 years, and now it's on the internet and it spreads all over the place. Cause you know, conspiracy theories are very popular among, especially Americans. There's like the paranoid or conspiracy theory of American history that just keeps cropping up with the Masons, you know, McCarthyism, all sorts of conspiracy theories pop up, and it captures the imagination of, you know, of the general public. Anyway, I hope to approach this differently than most, opponents of the Spalding theory. I was telling Bryce backstage that, they've been arguing and debating about this theory for over 100 years, and nothing seems to get solved or resolved about it. And I hope to introduce a methodology and a different kind of approach to the subject, as well as maybe a solving of the puzzle of how the phenomenon occurred.
This time I muted Bill.
Let's start off, Bryce. Why don't you, and what I asked each of you to do was to come to this show prepared to share 3, 4, 5 points, things that we did in the show that you either wanted to critique, offer insight on, or something that we didn't cover or that you thought needed to be clarified or have some extra context to. So with that, Bryce, would you get us started and share your first thought?
Yeah, so I understood that was kind of the petition as I was watching the two episodes, and I was watching it after the fact because unfortunately I have a permanent occupancy on Wednesday nights. As I was watching it, I was just making notes as I was going through them later. And if we wanted to go through all of those, we would be here for another 4 hours, just rehashing and rehashing and rehashing all of the data that you already went through. So that's a fruitless endeavor. I instead just decided to focus my efforts on basically just comparing the text of the manuscript story Conneaut Creek to the Book of Mormon, and presenting our potential authors and saying who is most likely as an author in this regard. So I did bring a slideshow. If you want to pull up the slides and kind of advance those as we go, I'll go through my notes and kind of we'll discover this all together, if that sounds okay. All right. So yes, very basically, this presentation is broken up into two separate categories. First, there is kind of the Book of Mormon versus the manuscript story, Conneaut Creek. And then B, I want to focus secondarily on the charges of conspiracy, the weight of the conspiracy, and kind of the primary concern and issue with Spalding theory is that it requires criminal conspiracy. So if we move to the first slide here, I think we should probably just discuss some of the broad textual overlaps between Manuscript Story, Conneaut Creek, and the Book of Mormon. Next slide, please. I think it would just be a good idea to just kind of see what these two things are. And we have, of course, on the left of our screen, the Manuscript Story, Conneaut Creek, and it is written in the handwriting of L.L. Rice, the discoverer, the person who rediscovered the manuscript in Honolulu, the Solomon Spaulding writings. He wrote that. However, Manuscript Story, Conneaut Creek there is written in Solomon Spaulding's hand. That is the title of this manuscript. And that is very important, of course, for the function that this is not the manuscript. This is just this was maybe a rough draft of manuscript found that served to be the basis for the Book of Mormon. So next slide, please. Just in broad strokes, if we just go over the manuscript story, this is kind of just a meta-analysis of it. The author is a person who is called a translator. They unearth records that are buried in a hill from a stone box with the assistance of a lever, very specifically. It describes or provides a history of Native Americans, their customs, their warfare, their agriculture, their industry, their coinage, their government, their religious practices, and so on and so forth. It all fictional. I want to point this out. It is all fictional. Right. It also discusses white-skinned, enlightened lawgiver who brings true religion, which was understood as Christianity, to and a system of theocracy of government to the people. It has dark-skinned, static tribes who are at war with the enlightened righteous tribes. It contains correspondences among military leaders during military conflicts that are written essentially as epistles, as letters back and forth. And then there are several common European American settler anachronisms. And that includes horses, that includes metal weapon, metal armor, the use of elephants, as it is called in manuscript story, the mammoons, he's alluding to them as mammoths. The second spelling, he actually uses mammoths. They're used as beasts of burden for plowing and for riding and for so on and so forth. And then it also does not accurately describe in any detail any of the real existing indigenous cultures. And now, if we go to the Book of Mormon and discuss its broad strokes, well, just flip between the slides real quick, just back and forth. It looks
pretty much the same. Same as the one before.
Just go back.
That is the next slide.
I think the difference is curious. Yeah, and humans.
Go back again. And now forward.
The Mammoons have it.
Okay, so this is a very basic and simple point to make, that there are very many similarities between the manuscript story and the Book of Mormon, and that I argue that these are not just superficial similarities, that these actually hold, that these are actually foundational, content, contextual, as well as environmental and social milieu of the time of the 18th, 19th century America, that these books are written within the culture and context of the time. Okay. So next slide, please.
Bryce, I have to interrupt to ask Bill a question. Am I timing this? Because we talked about 5 minutes per side.
Let's try to keep them to near about 5 minutes on each.
Okay. This is my first point. Now. It's a big one. Okay.
Okay, Bryce, you're at 4:32 now, and I apologize for not calling you at 1 minute to give you notification. I did stop the stopwatch right here.
Okay.
I've got going, and I'll just let you know when you're done at 5 minutes, and that'll be in 27 seconds.
Okay. Another point that I want to discuss is affixations. And this is how fiction writers will oftentimes manufacture proper nouns. They will oftentimes use suffixes or prefixes among the proper nouns. And we see with manuscript story, Spaulding's method of his affixations. And then we have Joseph Smith's method of affixations. Basically, I argue that the mind that dreamt up these proper nouns is the same mind. That we see very, very similar tendencies with the proper nouns. So,
5 minutes.
Yeah.
You do with it what you want, Bill. I'm just keeping time.
Yeah, totally. Go ahead and finish your thought here. I don't want to cut you short, but please.
That was my first point. And what I actually did in addition to this, so if you go to the next slide, I did bring a number of examples from both Manuscript Story and Conneaut Creek that if we have a little extra time, I can go through and read those. And then we can maybe even have the listeners chime in if they think it's from Manuscript Story or if they think it's from the Book of Mormon. Quiz the viewers. How well do they know their book?
Let's do two or three of them.
Okay. All right. I'm good with that. All right. So I have make a choice. Number 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5.
Let's go number 2.
Number 2. Gracious God, how deplorable our situation. Are we doomed to dwell among hordes of savages and be deprived of all social intercourse with friends in the civilized world? And what will be the situation of our offspring? Will they preserve our customs and manners, cultivate the arts and sciences, and maintain our holy religion? Or will they not rather degenerate into savages and by mingling with them become the most wicked race of beings in existence?
Wow. Yeah, I would guess that's the Conneaut Creek manuscript story.
Yeah, that's not the Book of Mormon.
Fabius.
But there are some similar things there.
Chapter 4.
That was Fabius.
Yes, that is Fabius, very specifically. Yep. Yeah, and so, I mean, I have other ones.
Is that a character in the Conneaut Creek manuscript?
That's Mormon.
Exactly. Well, sort of.
It's the editor, writer, commentator, whatever. Yeah.
Yes.
Let's do one more, and then we'll turn some time over here to Dan to cover his first
point.
Okay.
1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 4, or 5.
Let's do number 5.
Now there was no law against a man's belief, for it was strictly contrary to the commands of God that there should be. Okay. There you go. Very good.
So there are.
I think it applies better when I go through them and randomize them. But you know, in any case, it's illustrative. I want to just make this point very briefly. You read from the late war in one of the two episodes, and it starts with, and now it came to pass in the year of blah, 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 and it continues its narrative. I argue that those are superficial differences. However, I argue that the similarities, when you read through Manuscript Story, that the language, the flow of the narrative, and just kind of had the way that the author makes the reader feel feels very similar to the Book of Mormon. And I think a lot of people who read the Manuscript Story, Conneaut Creek, coming from a Mormon background, have that same kind of instinctual response to reading Manuscript Story.
Bryce, you said just a bit ago that talking about "and it came to pass" as a superficial difference. Did you mean superficial similarity between the two?
Similarity. I meant similarity between late war and the Book of Mormon. Correct.
Also, did you mean to spell the second witch WITCH? And if so, what is the meaning there?
It's just a little dig at Joseph Smith and occult treasure digging and magic and
yeah. Okay. I thought there must be something behind that.
Right. Okay. So point number one, Bryce there. Dan, will you take us into what your first thought here?
And I'm going to start the timer now. Now, Dan, Bryce went over.
It's not fair because Bryce speaks a lot faster than I do.
He really does. But he went over 2 minutes. You only have 3 minutes to give us what you want to say. I'm kidding. I'll give you a full 5 right, and I'll give you a 1 minute warning.
And start off with here, just as an introduction. Hope this isn't part of my 5 minutes, but here's me and Bryce at the Sunstone Symposium. He had me sign my books that are stacked up right there. And Bryce is a really tall guy because I'm like 6'2". And no, I'm just joking.
Okay, you're at 1 minute.
Bryce is really tall. Okay.
You have 1 minute left, Dan. I'm kidding. I'll stop this. I'm going to restart stature. Right now, okay, for you.
This is mine. Why the Spalding theory can't be true. And the main points that I will be making are the following. The Spalding theory doesn't fit with what we know from better evidence about the Book of Mormon's production and the circumstances of Sidney Rigdon's conversion. The Spalding theory is best explained by reference to memory studies, specifically the phenomenon known as memory conformity or the social contagion of memory. And the third point, the origin of the Spalding theory was specifically conducive to memory conformity. Fourth point is Rigdon did not steal the Spalding manuscript from the printer because the manuscript, according to the widow, was returned. And the last point, Widow Spalding and her daughter believed the manuscript in the trunk was copied by Rigdon and became the Book of Mormon, claiming that it contained Book of Mormon names. a clear case of memory conformity, because we know inside the trunk was the Conneaut manuscript. Next slide. Mm-hmm. So the additional points. Oh, next slide.
Yeah, it moved, but sorry. Go ahead.
Oh,
the clock's still ticking.
Okay. No, that's it. Next slide.
Okay.
I see the same slide.
I still see the same.
I feel like I should have
to. I will go read it. I will tell it. Additional points will be: there is no credible evidence connecting Smith and Rigdon before December 1830. The second additional point: the well-dressed stranger at the Smith farm in 1827 was not Rigdon, but was Joseph Knight Sr. or Josiah Stoll. And the last additional point: similarities between Rigdon's pre-1830 teachings and the Book of Mormon are superficial and best explained by a radicalization of Campbellism, whereas Joseph Smith learned the Seeker gospel from his father and Jason Mack. So next slide.
So give me a second. My internet just went out, and I
okay. Stop the clock.
I got taken off of the whole stream here. So give me 2 moments. Maven looks like she's.
Oh, there's the okay. There. Hey, stop. There you go. That's good. That's good. Okay, the translation procedure. Spalding theory imagines the translation occurred like the image on the left, and on the right is the actual method, which is very difficult to explain in the context of Joseph Smith, that Rigdon wrote up the manuscript, Joseph Smith read the manuscript, and the scribes wrote it down. How can you get it the same, you know, if you're not hiding behind a curtain or something? If you have your head in the hat, much more difficult to do. Next slide. Okay, I won't read this, but this is Bill Davis's book. And he goes through why the manuscript that we have is an oral production, not a reading of a manuscript. It's not sight. It's an oral presentation. Okay. And he talks about heads and use of skeletal outlines that are evident in some places in the Book of Mormon. Next slide. So here are some examples I have of characteristics of orally composed text. And I have a few of them, but there's many more. The first example, Alma 24:19 says, "And thus we see that they buried their weapons of peace," or "they buried their weapons of war for peace." Well, this is what is an oral correction of a mistake made in oral composition. The next one is interesting. It says, well, on the other hand, there was now and then a man fell among the Nephites by their swords and the loss of blood, they being shielded from the more vital parts of the body, or the more vital parts of the body being shielded from the strokes of the Lamanites. I think you're getting the point here that it's an oral presentation, so I'll move on to the next slide. Here's the evidence of oral composition. Joseph Smith dictated with his head in the hat. Text shows evidence of oral composition rather than reading from a text. Joseph Smith was unable to replace the stolen manuscript. Original plan less religious than Sidney Rigdon's involvement would entail, meaning the Book of Mormon itself tells us that the replacement text was more religious than the previous text that had been lost. Contents shows evolution of purpose and major plot line. And this is what I have in mind here, is that it becomes more religious as it goes on and shows that it's being developed as it's being dictated. And the last part was a major plot line. And one thought here is...
There's 5 minutes.
Brent Medcalf's article on the priority of Mosiah shows that the later prophets didn't know that Jesus was coming to America, whereas the replacement text, Nephi, knew. Joseph Smith's dictation shows influence from immediate events in his environment. If you read my biography of Joseph Smith, you'll see a lot of examples of that. Contents reflects Joseph Smith's biography, not Rigdon's. Everybody knows about Lehi's dream and what Lucy Smith related to Joseph Smith Sr.'s dream.
So Bill, you heard me say 5 minutes. Okay, I just want to make sure.
Yeah, I got a little bit extra, didn't I?
Yeah, you did.
Go ahead.
You absolutely did.
That, I don't need that one.
You don't need this one.
I'm done with my point, basically.
Okay. Can I ask Dan a question here? Is that okay, Bill?
Mm-hmm.
Just so I say, if it doesn't fit, this is my methodology. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Perfect.
And so
I want to get some orange juice.
So when we're faced with all the myriads of testimony, I think Bryce said in one of his interviews, there's 36 individual testimonies. It's difficult to go one by one and show how their memories aren't really working and that there's problems or they contradict themselves. I give priority to the Mormon sources here because they're more certain than they are with 20-year-old plus memories telling us this thing. And I have a theory that will explain how everybody got it wrong.
Okay.
You had a question, RFM?
I did. It was for Dan, and it raised the question in my mind when you were talking about the different methods of translation, that it makes sense that if he's on the other side of a curtain, then he could have access to a book that he is reading from, but not so much so if he has his head in the hat.
You can't get the whole Book of Mormon in the hat.
Right.
You might be able to get notes and things like that. I know about your theory, RFM.
But without that crazy theory.
Okay.
How do you account for vast swaths of the King James Bible occurring in the Book of Mormon?
Yeah, well, so the witnesses testified that there was no manuscripts or books being used. And what they were doing was combating the Spalding theory. Not all of them. Some of them gave their testimony of the methodology, like Isaac Hale saw with the head in the hat, and others commented on the head in the hat without any reference to Spalding. But David Whitmer, especially, and Emma Smith, were asked about the Spalding theory, and that's what they were trying to argue against. So the King James Version passages, those long chapters, is a small part of what went on. And it doesn't mean that David Whitmer happened to be there that one day or 2 days or 3 days, whatever it took to do it. But even if he saw that taking place, if Joseph Smith did introduce the King James text, like he would later do the inspired revision of the Bible, where they used the Bible and Joseph Smith made changes here and there, he may have just simply used the Bible and said, I'm going to make these changes, and it'd be much easier on my eyes if I just read it here and make the inspired changes. And he could have introduced it that way without anybody saying, oh, that's cheating. You know, nobody's going to go, oh, that's cheating. You can't do that. So I don't think getting his head out of the hat for the King James Version somehow impeaches the testimony of the witnesses that saw his head in the hat.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Vogel. Mr. Blankenagel, how do you respond to the same question?
I think that it's this kind of gets to the thrust of what Spalding is so, or why Spalding is so controversial, is because it requires criminal elements. It requires individuals who are acting as scribes to be in on the con with Joseph Smith. And I don't necessarily see that as something that is an insurmountable issue. If Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery are working together to devise this manuscript with the help of Sidney Rigdon, then the methodology which they used to, you know, the source text that they copied from, I mean, you know, it's just the two of them working up in that, you know, upstairs room together. Who knows what they were doing? To that end, right, the Joseph Smith's inability to reproduce the manuscript, had he been working off of a source text, he should have been able to reproduce the lost 116 pages Lehi instead of coming up with a new narrative arc set in the same timeline with Nephi. However, if he were a smart plagiarist, he would be burning the source material as he was using it, and therefore that also still accommodates the loss of the 116 pages, that accommodates the inclusion of directly plagiarized texts like the book, like the Bible, and any other potential source text that might be pointed to as being possible, like the late war, like the view of the Hebrews, because suddenly this opens, you know, if we get Joseph's head out of the hat, then his eyes can be looking at any book that he is reading out, and, you know, making a synchronized text from multiple different sources.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll turn the time over to you, Bryce, for point number two.
Okay. All right, so number two, this should be pretty brief. I want to discuss Sidney Rigdon's pseudepigrapha. And this is, I think, really interesting, just kind of as a way of background. When Sidney Rigdon was kind of making his break off away from the Campbellite movement in the early 1820s, something that he wrote as essentially a commentary on the... I'm sorry, just need to check my slides real quick and make sure I have everything right. Okay. Yeah. So part of the purpose that this served was it was a pseudepigraphic text. He called it the Epistle of Peter, and it was basically written in a biblical style in order to comment on the function of bureaucratic churches at the time. So next slide, please. So this is, it was part of a larger pamphlet that was just dealing with a little bit of inner fighting and drama among multiple church leaders. But the end of it is appended this third epistle of Peter. And this is something that is very important that we acknowledge the timeline. This is 1824. This would have been at very earliest, 1 year after Rigdon likely came into contact with the manuscript, but as many as possibly 8 years after he came into contact with the manuscript. He wrote this pseudepigraphic text. So if you can go to the next slide, please. Here are just kind of the highlights of it. This was published after it came, he came into possession of it. This was written satirically. The introduction to it says that it was found among other old manuscripts by a wandering monk. It is signed Translator. It is written in the King James Version biblical style. It comments on the bureaucracy of organized religion and how wealthy hired ministers were, essentially priestcraft, as we would know it from the Book of Mormon, right? And then it also, the introduction is interesting because it says that it cannot prove the authenticity of the, or that the translator cannot prove the authenticity of the original. And they simply ask that in order to prove the truthfulness of this pseudepigraphic text, you just have to judge it against its commentary on society. And if it is an accurate commentary on society, therefore it is true. And once again, the introduction signs it as translator, who was described as a wandering monk. So once again, that's the only point here. Sidney Rigdon publishes this. It has exactly all of the same hallmarks of manuscript story and Book of Mormon, with a found text, somebody who is a translator of it, and it is lost scripture.
This is an item that Sidney Rigdon published.
Yes, in 1824.
I'm not familiar with this at all. So this is an interesting little thing that,
I mean, I'm not that far over time on this block, at least, am I?
No, you have 2 minutes and 10 seconds
remaining. I will do my best to find this. Of course, I have a
thousand. RFM, did you know this one?
No.
That Sidney Rigdon published.
Something. I don't either.
That's pretty cool.
I did not know about the third epistle of Peter.
I'm sorry. This is
no. We caught you off guard with the question, so
I tried to be very quick and have everything condensed and short, so I didn't want to bring huge extracts of it. But yeah, here it is. So this is hosted on Sidney Rigdon. This is one of Dale Broadhurst's site. So I'll just read the preface. This is how the epistle came to be overlooked, or how the following epistle came to be overlooked by early saints of Christendom and by all the fathers, or whether it was purposely suppressed by the Council of Nice, the Nicene Creed, and why it was at last destined to be found with other old manuscripts among the ruins of an ancient city by a miserable wandering monk, are all circumstances which my limited knowledge of these subjects do not enable me to explain. Then it goes through. So this is just the opening. It's like 8 chapters or 9 chapters. It says here, very first chapter, "Now ye who are called and chosen to go forth to all nations and among all people in time present and time to come to preach the word, see ye take to yourselves marks, nay, many outward marks, whereby ye shall be known of men. Be ye not called as men are called, but be ye called Pope, Archbishop, Archdeacon, or Divine, or Reverend, and Right Reverend, or some other holy name, so you may show forth your honor and calling." It talks about reverend titles being graven thereon. It talks about plates of brass. It talks about curious workmanship. It talks about richest silk. So needless to say, there's just a lot of material within the third epistle of Peter that just smacks a lot like the Book of Mormon. And importantly, this is Sidney Rigdon published pre-Book of Mormon as commentary on the present state of religion.
Can I follow up with a question, Bryce? How... Yeah. How common was this sort of practice of writing pretend scripture back in Joseph Smith's day?
I mean, it's not something that was unheard of. It was something that was just relatively uncommon. I myself have not come into contact with anything that smacks like this written from anybody, especially someone who is associated as a high profile reverend, you know, pastor of a Campbellite movement who is trying to break away from the movement, and, you know, has his own message, of course. So, but there must be other examples out there like this. I myself have not come into contact with any. But that would definitely lessen the gravity of this, right? But
if everybody was doing
at face value, this smacks pretty strong evidence.
And I just want to know what little bit I'm able to sort of research as you're talking. I guess it is proposed that Rigdon is the possible publisher of this document. I'm not seeing
along
that that's
with Walter Scott. That is
correct. Yes, and I do see his name on the
and
document.
It was written essentially as a defense of Alexander Campbell. It's a long, long pamphlet, but there was some infighting going on about the whether certain ordinances had been performed on the certain day or whether or not Alexander Campbell had denied giving somebody a blessing who was ill. And he basically, part of this pamphlet was just trying to clear Alexander Campbell's name. And along with it, Rigdon published this, or at least it is theorized that Walter Scott used Rigdon's help in order to publish this third epistle.
Yeah, and I just want to read what I found here. Rigdon possibly responsible for the fabrication of a third epistle of Peter, which was found with other old manuscripts among the ruins of an ancient city by a miserable wandering monk. Yeah, that's been the quote church. That's the quote from the manuscript. Then yes. Translated into English by an unknown translator. Maybe this is what you just read.
Yeah, that's the introduction.
So at least interesting in that here, if that's true, you have Rigdon publishing pseudo scripture before the Book of Mormon, which I think adds some interest to the storyline.
Well, I'd like to answer RFM's question because I know that this pseudo-biblical style was common in the 19th century. I mean, we have the Book of Pukey by Abner Cole. We have the
Wait a
war,
minute. You mean Obadiah Dogberry, right?
Oh, yeah. Dogberry was a pseudonym.
But citing that as an example of how prevalent that was is kind of disingenuous because it was specifically published as a satire
it's in newspaper.
Of the Book of Mormon.
He's using Obadiah Dogberry or Abner Cole was using a style to ridicule the Book of Mormon that was common among newspaper writers that wanted to make their criticism of current politics more interesting. It's you can find it in a lot of places in the newspapers in the 19th century. So it was a common style to adopt the chronicles of so-and-so and...
Do either of you think that the late war is an example of this?
Yeah.
It uses the biblical style, yes. However, it is not publishing a commentary on society the way that the Third Epistle of Peter is or the Book of Mormon is or whatever. It is publishing it specifically as a book of history.
Yeah, there are other ones that do talk about current politics in a biblical style and they ridicule it. And they, just like Abner Cole. Abner Cole didn't invent that. What he used the Book of Pukey because that was a common way of handling things in a kind of a not a direct way, you know.
Yeah,
to keep it interesting.
Yeah, and just to play sort of a tiebreaker, I think whether it is a consistent thing that's happening or not, if Rigdon is partial author or creator of this pseudo scripture, it's still Rigdon creating pseudo scripture prior to the Book of Mormon, which again, I just think either way, whether this is all over the place or whether this is a one and done and Rigdon's kind of the unique person, it certainly seems to stand out regardless.
I do just really quickly want to address Abner Cole, just to confront that head on, right? So the Book of Pukey is actually not the only biblical satire that he wrote about Joseph Smith. There are predating in the Palmyra Reflector three or four different novels, or, you know, little snippets that he publishes in the biblical style. And he is doing it because he has access to the printer's manuscript of the Book of Mormon and the early copies of it. He is doing it specifically to make fun of Joseph Smith's writing. writing. Yeah. So I don't hold that up as an example to indicate how common this was in society. I hold that up only.
I'm telling you, there are lots of examples. I'm just in the newspapers, and I've made notes of them. And they're usually called the Chronicles of whatever, you know, and it's sarcasm. It's like Benjamin Franklin being sarcastic about the current politics and making fun of the current politics.
And I don't want to spend, because I think it's sort of off in the weeds a touch, I don't want to spend a ton of time arguing that. So
I want to ask Bryce.
This is important because this is a data point that wasn't presented that is very integral to the Spalding theory. So that's why I wanted to present this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is Rigdon's authorship a sure thing?
Can I ask you, that's what Dan is saying, is what the impression I was getting is we're almost playing 8 degrees from Sidney Rigdon. It's like Walter Scott is the person who wrote or is attributed to having written the third epistle of Peter, right? Mm-hmm. And Sidney Rigdon is associated with him. And then later on, Sidney Rigdon becomes associated with Joseph Smith, who's doing this other thing. And it's almost like because there's the association, there's an impulse to make Sidney Rigdon be the one who wrote the third epistle of Peter instead of the person whose name is on it, which is Walter Scott. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So that is a fair criticism of this point, right? So there is nothing that it is not written such that, you know, Sidney Rigdon did not sign this, right? And it is satirical. It is written to be a satire. It is published under the name of Walter Scott. The entire pamphlet is. However, given the close association of Sidney Rigdon and Walter Scott, and they're falling out pretty soon after this, that this just indicates that that they were in close proximity with each other and they had similar leanings in 1824, and that, you know, they were both preachers in the same area at the same time and were best friends. And therefore, I think it just naturally leads to the conclusion that they likely collaborated on this project.
And I just want to note, here's one thing I found. The writing sample is a bit too short in this third epistle of Peter for conclusive computerized authorship identification, but the folks at Stanford who do such testing said that it most resembles the style of Sidney Rigdon of all the authorship candidates so far tested. So there's that as well.
Did they test Walter Scott?
I assume so, because it was the most likely candidates and he's attributed.
Sometimes you never know.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't know that for sure. Okay.
Let's bring it to the sink of things and I'll give it over to Bill and I'll get my little stopwatch out.
Yeah. So let's turn it back over to, again, no offense. I just want to try to, we're already at 7 o'clock, so we're already 40 minutes in. I want to try to get through these. So, Dan, I'm going to turn the time back over to you and let you make your next point.
All right. Let's see my slide, the next one. There we are. Cool, huh? So, memory is not a simple storage and retrieval process, but much more complex, even malleable. You can have memories of things that never happened, especially things you only heard 20 years before. Memory studies have demonstrated that. Memory can be altered or contaminated through suggestion of other witnesses or authority figures, suggestive or misleading questions like what Hurlbut employed, encountering new similar information like the Book of Mormon. Book of Mormon itself can contaminate their memories. Hearing misinformation can contaminate memory. Cognitive mistakes, source misattribution, confusing something you heard as what happened to you, especially many years later. The tendency to confabulate under pressure, convince yourself to please others, like maybe the police interrogators. Next slide. Next. Okay, this is just out of Wikipedia, real easy thing to read. Memory conformity, also known as social contagion of memory, is a phenomenon where memories or information reported by others influences an individual and is incorporated into the individual's memory. When witnesses compare notes, for example, that's why the police keep them apart. Next slide. This is long, but I'm not going to read it all. Laboratory studies. And so this is psychiatrists, mostly study this as a phenomenon. It's real. Okay. Even when the subject's initial, oh, Whoops. I'll read that first part on the top. Even when the subject's initial memories were very accurate, individuals who discussed their memory with someone who had witnessed a slightly different scene exhibited a decrease in accuracy due to conformity. Okay, I think you get the point. So next slide. This is a meme I found. I thought it was quite interesting about the different ways memory conformity can work. Eyewitness testimonies. A lot of people have been convicted wrongfully due to eyewitness testimony, and RFM can talk to that probably. Group discussions, people talking among each other can change people's memories of it. Media, listening to the media, public events, families, stories, traditions handed down that gets put into a formula. And so parts are dropped out and one story remains. Next slide. So I say the Spalding theory, the origin of the Spalding theory is conducive to memory confirmation or conformity, excuse me. And so in February 1832 is when Orson Pratt and Samuel Smith came to Conneaut and preached. And they just described the context of the Book of Mormon in a very general way. And afterwards, one Nehemiah King went out of the building declaring that Hyde had preached from the writings of Solomon Spalding. He knew that just by hearing a general description of the Book of Mormon's contents. And that's because both authors are being inspired by the Mound Builder myth. Okay, that's, and it's a very similar story. 20 years later, this is conducive to be having memory distortion, memory conformity, and it gets told and retold. And this map here shows you how close everybody is that Hurlbut interviewed at Conneaut at the top and Conneautville at the bottom. And Albion was another scene where he learned about stuff, but in West Springfield, all these places were where the witnesses lived, the eight different witnesses, or seven of them anyway, and they all talked with each other for more than a year before Hurlbut showed up. Okay, am I done?
It's no, you've got 20 seconds left.
Oh, okay.
But at the bottom, so the summary, this witnesses were discussing their 20-year-old memories for 18 to 19 months before Hurlbut interviewed them.
Even interviewed them. And they're talking with the other people. And Hurlbut is conveying some of the information the other witnesses said. So-and-so said that they remember this, the names Moroni, Nephi, Lehi. Do you remember those names?
Very
leading. And so it's a very conducive environment for this whole thing to spark off from here because of Nehemiah King.
And there's time.
And I'll just note here that the other side of the coin is that rather than Hurlbut really being the one to influence them to sort of originate the story, they were reporting that they thought this was the same story long before Hurlbut ever comes around. Correct?
Right. From talking to each other.
Yeah, yeah, totally. No, totally understand
each
that.
Each other and other people. And, well, for the husband and wife, especially the brother of Solomon Spalding, John Spalding and his wife, gave nearly the same testimony. So that's my summary of my second point anyway.
Yeah, love it.
Actually, excellent. If I could, I actually kind of want to flip this around because I have a question for RFM when it comes to this. I want, what is, because you've sat in on criminal procedures once or twice before. How are spontaneous utterances treated in a criminal court?
Spontaneous, they're admissible. It's an exception to the hearsay rule.
Okay. So, and why is that?
Because our general understanding in common law and experience, blah, 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 is that if you say something while you're still under the excitement of the event itself, then you have not had time to think about creating a lie about it. In other words, the closer it is and the more excited you are, someone just, you know, pointed a gun at you and took your money, and then they ran off, and you find somebody like within a couple minutes and you're out of breath, and you say, it was this guy, he did it, and let's say then you die. Maybe you got shot, whatever. But you're still excited under the excitement of it having happened, and therefore what the law says is that that has a heightened credibility built into it.
Right.
That it wouldn't have if it were after the excitement had worn off and if a person had had a chance to confabulate.
Right, right. So I bring that up as a leading question because I see that the accounts that Hurlbut have that collected, yes, indeed, he collects them after the events happen. However, that there is evidence of spontaneous utterances in this. The man walking away immediately, and you know, like it's recorded in Orson Hyde's journal, I believe that that the meeting broke up in confusion. I think is the very specific words that he used. One person walked away with the utterance that that man just preached from Solomon Spaulding's writings. I see that as a spontaneous utterance. Another spontaneous utterance is old come to pass has come to life again that was uttered upon hearing the information. So I only bring that up as a standard of evidence because like this is something that is well understood and has an exception in the hearsay for especially for criminal interactions, spontaneous criminal interactions, and that these smack to me as they are spontaneous utterances and therefore should possibly be given a little more credibility beyond just having the people had time right. to talk it. And I say that because
why it's not. It's not a crime or anything. It's a memory, a 20-year-old memory that I'm not arguing.
I mean, they're alleging.
Lying. I'm not arguing he's lying. I'm arguing that he was mistaken.
Okay. Okay. All right. I guess that's where we kind of come to a disagreement on this.
It's a 20-year-old memory, and all he heard was an outline of the Book of Mormon, and that was enough. He hadn't even read the book.
What I hear you so saying,
how
Bryce,
reliable can that testimony be?
What I hear you saying, Bryce, is that as the Mormon missionaries are preaching, some of these witnesses are drawn up in that moment to go like, whoa, right there. He's plagiarizing the Book of Mormon, as if that moment was a recounting of a memory of them hearing it in the past and them sort of making that connection.
Yes, I am saying that they made the spontaneous utterances at the time that it happened, and then Hurlbut came along a year later and said, hey, what happened at that meeting? They say, oh, well, this, you know, I said, old come to pass has come to life, or I heard someone say, old come to pass has come to life again. They are remembering spontaneous utterances.
So, we don't know what he remembered. We only know that he said that Hyde was preaching from Solomon Spaulding's writings. We don't know exactly what he thought. We can't test cross-examine him. We can't test his memory. So we can't, and it's really, this is a hearsay testimony by Aaron Wright many years later about King. We don't have anything by King. Okay. So what we're doing is reconstructing the historical event that sparked everybody else thinking, well, is it similar? So there's memory studies where they implant memories in people by saying that never happened to the people. And they said they would interview people and say, we talked to your mother. And do you remember this event, that event, this event? And then they sneak one in that's not, they know for sure what didn't happen. Do you remember getting lost in the mall and when you were a child and you were crying and stuff? And the person, you know, about, it could be like 70% of the people could say, not really. And then a month later, they interview them again. Do you remember that? And they go, I think I have a vague memory of that now. And then they interview them even later and they go, yeah, I remember that. And these are studies. Memory is malleable. It can be edited by other people, not just yourself. Memories can be even implanted by suggestion, just the mere suggestion of it.
I will say, though, Dan, the ability to plant false memories doesn't give us a litmus test to figure out or dismiss true ones. In other words, we're sort of left here sorting out whether these are true memories or not.
Yes. So my argument is that because the Spalding theory does not match what we know from better evidence about the origins of Mormonism. That puts, we are right to be skeptical of this testimony. And I'm not offering this as evidence against, I'm offering it as an explanation of why.
Yeah, totally.
Bryce, can I ask you a question? You said an expression a couple of times, which is unfamiliar to me. And it sounds like what was peace is now life, went from peace to life. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Did you say it twice?
Was it the end it came to pass quote maybe he's referring
to? No, it was, I thought he was saying it came from peace and it came to life or something like that. You said that twice.
I will defer to the chat because my memory is having a hard time recalling what was said literally 5 minutes ago.
I'm not trying to implant a memory.
No. This is illustrative, right? Because you are saying something, you are recalling something that has happened in this conversation. I have been sitting in this conversation.
I don't remember it.
And I don't remember it. Bill doesn't remember it. So did it happen or did it not?
Look, does anybody else in the live chat know what the heck it is I'm talking about? Because I'm just trying to ask a question is what it means. Because I've heard it twice. Yeah. I can't remember the exact language.
Just to make sure, RFM, you said something about when they heard and it came, and it came to pass here all over again. You did say a quote from the Conneaut witness that said that when
the past become to life again.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. What was it?
Old come to pass has come to life again.
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean?
Meaning that the Book of Mormon says it, and it came to pass so much that, and that the Spalding manuscript also used it, so that when the Conneaut witnesses heard the Mormon missionaries saying, and it came to pass, reading the Book of Mormon, it was all too familiar to them. Oh, here we go again. It's some more, and it came to passes.
No,
yeah, and they said that after they read the Book of Mormon.
So it's specifically
after they read the Book of Mormon, they remembered Lehi and Nephi, and it came to pass.
Hold on,
the names are linked to, and it came to pass. Okay,
so
that
utterance is specifically the context of it is that that Solomon Spalding had the nickname of Come to Pass, Old Come to Pass. Yeah. And that this person is hearing, and it came to pass so much, and they are hearing the preachers from the Book of Mormon. This person shouts, and passes come to life again.
Yeah, so he may have life again. Used the phrase, and it came to pass, but not necessarily when in his writings.
I think I got it now.
So Solomon Spalding, according to his associates, was known as Old Came to Pass because he used the phrase, and it came to pass so often.
Yeah. That is correct. Yes.
Perfect. Thank you.
Is there any contemporary evidence of the fact that they called him that? Do you know?
I think it is only that one account that calls him, that names him Old Come to Pass and says Old Come to Pass has come to life again. I don't think there.
So it could have just been the fact
that I just happened to have my handy dandy study copy of Mormonism Unveiled that has all of the most important affidavits here at the back of it.
Okay, well, go ahead and check that out. I just want to make a passing observation. That it could be that this individual heard a passage from the Book of Mormon read by the preacher, perhaps Orson Hyde, and there were a number of it came to passes in this passage, and that's what made him think of the Solomon Spalding manuscript.
Right, and that's why he's saying it's sort of a spontaneous utterance, because he hears the Mormon missionary reading, and it came to pass over and over again, and that to him is direct evidence, because Solomon Spalding is old came to pass, because that's exactly what he did. Yeah.
Well, I love it. So did a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, sure, whoever wrote the late war, sure.
Well, anybody that spoke, tried to imitate the Bible.
Yeah, and just a note, because we're going to, I think, go into this next week, but this A Marvelous Work and a Wonder, part two that Book of Mormon Central just put up. One of the evidences they use of the Book of Mormon being an ancient text is the fact that it uses, and it came to pass so often. Well, when I go to look at the late war, when I get through the first 33 pages, it's already been used 16 times or something. And it came to pass isn't a Hebrewism. It seems to be part of 1820, 1830 literature all over the place.
And perhaps it's a feature of that literature precisely because it is used so often, at least in the Old Testament. And I think we had a much more Bible literate society at the time.
Yep. Bryce, keep looking for that. Let me turn the time over to Dan. And Dan, you can share your next point. I believe we're on Dan, correct?
Is it your turn? I thought we just got done with Dan.
No, yeah, we're on to my next point. And okay, let's right here. So the last 10 minutes of colloquy is exactly why I decided to focus on the text themselves. Because if we are talking about the reliability of statements, like that's all we're going to talk about. It's always going to be the foundations of, is this true? Is there something to the witness statements? Therefore, the theory is true. Or are these witness statements reliable because of the lack of reliability through which the methods that they were collected? So that's why I want to discuss the text. Like that's why my primary thrust is all about the text themselves. So
are you ready to go with your next point, Bryce?
Yes. Let's go to the slides. On my next slide, it should be the word print studies.
Go.
Okay. So I want to talk about just kind of generally Book of Mormon evidence and what the word print studies are useful for. I think it is important to point out that so far all of the primary or at least the peer published word print studies have proven inconclusive. There have been at least four major studies that have been done on this. There's the Larson Rencher Layton paper that was BYU studies. It concluded that there was multiple authors, relatively consistent with the authorship breaks within the Book of Mormon. There's the stylometric analysis of Mormon scriptures, and this was published in a non-Mormon affiliated journal by Holmes. And this specifically concluded that there was one author. However, there's questions about the methodology that was used in order to ascertain that. And the person, the marker that they used was richness of vocabulary to mark that it was one author, and that it does not reliably detect plagiarism or detect borrowing from other texts. It just detects whether or not an entire text seems to have been written by the same person. Then, of course, there's the Jocker study, and there was that was brought up in the previous presentations, and I think there's a little bit more to say on Jockers, but then responding to Jockers and kind of a meta analysis of this was Roper, Fields, and I don't know how to say this person's name. I've never met him before. I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to this scholar. I do not know how to pronounce your name. But this is another Journal of Book of Mormon Studies. This was a meta-analysis essentially discussing all of the different word print analysis studies that have been done. And they concluded that it was multiple authors consistent with the ancient text because it was Journal of Book of Mormon Studies, largely a faithful journal. So of these, I think Jockers is possibly the most interesting to discuss. And this was flashed at the very end of it. And what I want to kind of glean from this information is that there is data here, right? You look at a big color graph like this, it's just like, wow, colors, black and white and stark and whatever. But there's a lot of data that is available to us. And Jockers has been rightfully criticized for their methodology, as well as the way that they ascertained that they profiled the various authors. And of course, Joseph Smith had to be excluded from that authorship pool because there are not pre 1830 Joseph Smith texts enough of a sample size to grab his author print, right? So therefore, he had to be excluded. So I think what's important to kind of mine out of this is to see the markers that Jockers used that they ascribed to Sidney Rigdon, that they ascribed to Parley Pratt, to Oliver Cowdery, and to Joseph Smith, and see where this is reflected in the Book of Mormon. And it is interesting to just look at this and see what chapters have more, let's say, a chapter of more yellow color. So it's really hard to see on the screen, obviously, but that's in Alma, say, somewhere around Alma 40, Alma 41, Alma 42. Well, that pings very highly as Cowdery. So you can you can go to that part in your Book of Mormon and read that passage, and you read it, and it sounds very different than the text that you are reading from, say, Ether, from this graph has a high blue signal, which is a Rigdon signal of authorship.
And Alma 40, 41, and 42, this would be in the area where Alma is giving the advice to his three sons, correct?
Yes. This is this is kind of in the beginning of the war chapters, and this is when Alma. Yes, we have. I think this is just after Alma the Younger's conversion story. So importantly, I only bring this here to address that the way that this was presented on the show, obviously, like, y'all had been going through this for hours and hours. It seemed like everybody on the panel was exhausted. This is a huge amount of data to just look at, and it's very, like, stark. However, if you just use this data in order to just flip open to a page on the Book of Mormon and you read that page, that you can see that there does seem to be what appears to be distinct authorship within the Book of Mormon. And I do not know how to reconcile multiple distinct authorship styles with the sole authorship theory. Finishing my point out here, I want to point this out. Go to the next slide here. That this leads to the conclusion that the Book of Mormon itself is kind of a modular book. There are the history passages, there are the sermon and prophetic activity passages, and when I say passages, chapters mostly. It's mostly chapters. There are the communications and the epistles chapters. A lot of those are in the war chapters, and there are the military leader communications that we also see in manuscript story. And then we have chapters and sometimes entire books that are just filling time gaps to get us from one point of narrative to the next book of narrative. I mean, think of the Minor Prophets, think of Words of Mormon. Fourth Nephi is just a chronicle of 300 years in a chapter. Then we have Jesus's appearance, which is a standalone feature of the Book of Mormon that is very interesting. And then we have the direct or indirect King James Bible plagiarisms. And these are kind of the different modules that you can see that the Book of Mormon is written in. And you can see. Fine.
And yeah, I'm sorry, I forgot to give you the 1 minute mark because I was so fascinated by what you were saying.
I will finish with just one point, that First Nephi and Second Nephi obviously ping highest as Joseph Smith's autobiographical portion of the Book of Mormon. And that, in my conclusion, is part of what he wrote. However, he wrote that section, those two chapters, after his entire writing style had been shaped by the rest of the Book of Mormon leading up to First and Second Nephi. And then he wrote those to replace the Book of Lehi that was lost. And the story that we see of in the First Nephi, the very first story we get is autobiographical, of our hero stealing a book of scripture so that he can plagiarize it and put it in his own book of scripture. And how that is not autobiographical of Joseph Smith, I don't know how we don't see that. If we grant autobiography in the Book of Mormon, I think we should just take that at face value.
And while you were looking, real quick, RFM, while you guys were looking, I found the quote concerning the same event at Conneaut. Reverend Abner Jackson states, when the Book of Mormon, was brought to Conneaut and read there in public, old Esquire Wright, Aaron Wright, heard it and exclaimed, old come to pass has come to life again. So there it is. RFM, go ahead.
Well, at least I've learned that much. And that was a really great point you made there, Bryce, about the autobiographical nature of that part of the story, which I had not considered before. Now, there are certain parts of the Book of Mormon that do seem to be very responsive to the environment in which it was being produced. And here I'm thinking about things like the Tree of Life, Dream, the reshaping of Isaiah chapter 29 in 2 Nephi 27 to make it much more closely correspond to Martin Harris's visit to Charles Anthon in New York. And there are several other things that go on. But am I correct that those places in the Book of Mormon that seem really responsive to Joseph Smith's environment, like I've mentioned, do they happen exclusively in 1st and 2nd Nephi, the part that would have been translated at the end? No. Bryce is shaking his head no.
No, there, Joseph Smith's elements of Joseph Smith's autobiography are replete throughout the Book of Mormon. And I think that is another important takeaway from the entire Spalding theory, is not that it claims that Sidney Rigdon stole this manuscript and then handed it to Joseph Smith complete, ready to publish, but that it was a collaboration between the two of them, and other individuals must have been associated with it as well. It was a collaborative authorship effort. And that's not a foreign concept to a lot of us.
And you're saying sort of that Laban is a sort of treasure guardian, right? He's guarding the brass plates that need to be stolen by Nephi in order to be used in another work of writing.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the autobiographical element, is that Joseph Smith had to get the gold plates in the same manner. It's only autobiographical if you first assume Sidney Rigdon stole the manuscript and is making some kind of reference to it. If you don't believe that, then it's not autobiographical. So you're kind of like begging the question in a way.
Well, so that's, I mean, there's a multiple ways to look at it, right? You can even read into the Book of Mormon.
Well, that's why it's dangerous to do that kind of stuff.
don't read it. Read into the autobiographical notions. The problem is that this is shrouded in mystery because the authorship needed to be concealed, right? The collaboration between Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon needed to be concealed. And therefore, that leaves a vacuum where we can put all sorts of theories into. One of those theories would be that there was a disagreement between Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon after he lost 116 pages, and that he had to, at some point, maybe purloin the manuscript from Sidney Rigdon during one of their annual meetings, right? And clandestine meetings in the woods annually in September, right? Maybe these weren't exactly communing with celestial entities so much as they were just business meetings, authorship powwows.
Are you saying Sidney Rigdon was the angel Moroni, Bryce?
Yeah, right. So that's part of this theory, right?
So this is one
integral piece to the theory as well, is that they had to meet.
Spalding theorists like to invent, they invent ad hoc hypotheses in order to get out of contrary evidence or counter evidence. So they invent a scenario that that Joseph Smith couldn't replace the lost 116 pages because he burned the manuscript as he was going along. Or they expand they use conspiracy to explain away evidence, not to explain evidence, but to explain away contrary evidence. Like, how did Sidney Rigdon get to hear about the Book of Mormon? It was all fortuitous. It was an accident that Parley P. Pratt went to New York and got converted, and then took the missionaries by Sidney Rigdon, and the Sidney Rigdon gets converted. And then the Spalding theorists have to imagine that Sidney Rigdon's just faking everything, and everything's a fake, and everything's just pretense, and nothing is like what it really seems, and except for their ad hoc theory or escape from counter evidence. The idea that there's no one in the room and there was people being, Joseph Smith was translating, is not right. You imagine that Joseph Smith and Robert Cowdery is alone in the room, but David Whitmer talked about how the family would get together in the mornings and they would pray and the translation would start. And that's how he saw what was going on. And they weren't up there by themselves, isolated and stuff. Emma said she was working in the same room as Oliver Cowdery and Joseph Smith, and she would move the plates and she would be dusting, and she's in the same room as them. So
right. This is the element of criminality that I think is really important to hone in on. And why I couched it the way that I did is because the criminality creates a black vacuum where we can put all sorts of theories and all sorts of explanations into, right? It can be helpful to make a parsimonious conclusion by creating a reasonable scenario. However, if that reasonable conclusion that you are coming to, if you are, you know, manufacturing a parsimonious set of circumstances, if any of those circumstances come into conflict with trustable evidence that is available, documentary or better, more qualified evidence, then you need to immediately jettison the hypothetical for the documentary. However, once again, because this is alleging a criminal conspiracy that is predicated on theft for the purposes of starting a religion that is a wink, nod, a fraud that all of the people who are authoring this are working together and recognize that it's a fraud, suddenly Emma Smith is incriminated, David Whitmer is incriminated, Oliver Cowdery, Martin Harris is incriminated, all of these individuals are incriminated in it. And, you know, that's something that's very difficult for the Spalding theory to get out from under, right? That's why this theory collapses from under its own weight.
But it's a growing conspiracy theory to handle contrary evidence, and at some point it has to collapse under its own weight.
Right. So that's kind of the overall point that I'm making, is that if we are examining the trustability of these sources, right, we have individuals who think that a manuscript from an old member of their village got stolen, and they're you know, testifying to what they believe, or we have individuals who their entire livelihoods, their entire social reputations, in most cases, their entire businesses and everything and their families are wrapped up in the belief that the Book of Mormon is true, and the continuing the narrative that the Book of Mormon is what it claims to be, that a lot of people will excuse their own criminal behaviors in order to, you know, not risk losing any of those things, which is to say that people like David Whitmer in the 1880s, who is running his own church that's predicated on the Book of Mormon, that is a competitor church to Brigham's church, to Sidney Rigdon's church, to any of the other churches, right? Him saying that the Book of Mormon and telling his version of the story, right? Like, he had a financial investment. He had a social capital. He had his own, his own business, his own everything wrapped up in the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon. So he's never going to divulge that he helped to plagiarize and author the Book of Mormon. Right. That is the mentality.
There's no
mentality of the approach.
There's no evidence of that. And that's why the conspiracy is creeping. It creeps and gobbles up more and more of the evidence in order to live itself. But the thing is you got to ask yourself, which is more reliable? 20-year-old memories of a book you heard read and all those weird names. I mean, anybody reading the Spalding manuscript probably can't remember many of the names in it, like Fabius. But 20-year-old memories or the head in the hat with multiple witnesses that are independent from one another, and that's more something they saw, not something they heard. It's something they experienced, okay? It was more dimensional than just hearing a book read to you 20 years ago that sounded sort of like the Mound Builder myth, which the Spalding's present manuscript that we have has all those elements in it.
All right, so Dan, I'm going to try to cut you off here and just so we can move on a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me just know, by the way, aside from the Spalding-Rigdon theory, I'm actually really interested in this whole Laban as a treasure guardian. Oh. Is it my memory or not that some of the guardian spirit mythology in treasure digging had the guardian spirit being headless?
I think a throat it was nearly cut. Headless, Nick.
The throat cut.
Certainly a bleeding ghost, right?
A throat cut, yes. And Laban...
But those were all incorrect anyway.
I know. But a throat slut or a throat slit.
Sorry, we're going to edit that out, folks.
You know, Spanish guardian spirit, whatever it was, Spaniard, throat slit Spaniard was the phrase.
Yeah.
Laban was also cut at the neck. Okay. All right. Well, then incorrect. I noted that. I thought Laban throat slit.
That was from Spaniard. Harmony, residence in Harmony that. Yeah. Confused it probably
bad memory
with
again.
The Spanish treasure
and
an iron chest and they actually thought down in Harmony that the gold plates came out of the hill and the hole in the hill that Joseph had dug for the Spanish treasure so they got it all wrong
More faulty memory. I know I got it so let's okay so
you got to test these people
they got it all wrong or Joseph Smith was duplicitous in everything that he said to anybody ever.
Which is, also maybe possible.
Yeah, it was pretty fluid. But
truth and reality were fluid to him.
Yeah.
I think we can all agree.
The question I'm having is, how do you trust anything that's coming out of any of these people at this time period about this?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, all right, Dan, your turn.
My third point. This is my actual third point.
I'm sorry, Dan. I'll start right now. Go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you. So I also was going to talk about similarities between the manuscript story and the Book of Mormon, but Bryce already did that, sort of. He left some things out that I think are pretty important. But it's the important thing is to remember that all these books, the Book of Mormon and Spalding's current manuscript that we have, were based on the Mound Builder myth, similar to Ethan Smith. He based his thing on the Mound Builder myth also. The Romans the Romans were blown off course. They come to America. They meet the Mound Builders there already. They're not the Romans aren't the Mound Builders. The Mound Builders are already there. But Spalding never tells where they came from, okay? And the book was never finished. I got to add that the book was never finished, and who knows what he was going to do. Maybe he did have plans. Maybe he did mention plans. Maybe he was going to write about the Lost Ten Tribes, but never got around to it. And the witnesses mixed up what he talked about with what he said was in the book, in the manuscript. So they all became congealed into one memory. They couldn't distinguish. They just thought everything Spalding talked about was in the manuscript. But the important part is that the manuscript describes the Ohans and the Kentucks. The Ohans are really Ohio Indians, or whoever they were, and the Kentucks, and they were on either side of the Ohio River, and they get in they develop. They're the same nation, the same people, and they have a high civil. Both sides have a high civilization, but they end up fighting each other over various reasons. And they bury each other in mounds of earth. They have picket works and fortifications. So this is what Solomon Spaulding was trying to explain. So next slide. This is just one of the witnesses, John Spaulding, Solomon Spaulding's brother. So I have on one side his, I took little excerpts of the historical matter and what he said was in the manuscript. And on the other side, the current Spaulding manuscript that we have, okay? And you'll notice that, so he talks about, on John Spaulding's side, that he talks about the first settlers of America. He says that his brother wrote about the first settlers of America, which were these Ohans and Kentucks and some other ones that were over in the Delaware area. And, but he doesn't say where they came from, but they go on to say that American Indians are the descendants of the Jews or the lost tribes from Jerusalem. Well, the lost tribes weren't from Jerusalem. They came by land and sea, which is a phrase that is repeated a lot in Horowitz documents, till they arrived in America under the command of Nephi and Lehi. Well, you look over here, they're Lucian and Fabius. Lucian's the captain of the ship. Fabius was a scribe. They became founders and judges of that civilization. Quarrels and contentions. Well, you know, Spaulding's manuscript talks about wars. And they separate into two distinct nations, Nephites and the other Lamanites. Well, we just mentioned the Ohans and they were also called Scioto's from the Scioto River in Ohio, and the Kentucks. Cruel and bloody wars ensued with great multitudes were slain. They buried their dead in large heaps, which caused the mounds to so common in the country, which is in the Book of Mormon and also in Spaulding's manuscript. Their art, sciences, civilizations were brought into view in order to account for all the curious antiquities found in various parts of North and South America. And over on the other side, that's in Spaulding's manuscript. He wrote, and this is the part that's not in that manuscript. He wrote in the old style, and he used the, and it came to pass phrase. These names and styles remembered while reading the Book of Mormon, and I contend that this was confabulated into that memory. So I propose that we interpret Horowitz's witnesses as corrupted memories of Spaulding's extant manuscript, conversations with Spaulding, in which he may have discussed the 10-tribe theory, corrupted by discussions among themselves and reading the Book of Mormon and the manner Horowitz interviewed them. So nobody asked them to tell what was in the manuscript before they read the Book of Mormon. They only described what they read.
Okay. Love it.
That's a problem for me, is that they didn't volunteer any information about Spaulding's manuscript that they hadn't read in the Book of Mormon. They only said, yeah, I read it, and this is what matches. So that's a very shaky situation.
Yeah. Okay. So technically, we should be starting to wrap up right now. I'm going to give you guys a few more minutes to do one more point. Yeah, one more point each.
I have a question here before we get to the next point. I apologize.
Yeah.
Is there any place in this discussion for what I presume is the fact that the people who were talking about the similarities between the Book of Mormon and the Solomon Spaulding manuscript were not Mormon and were probably antagonistic to Mormons and were probably inclined to try and find a natural explanation for the Book of Mormon?
What reason did they have to be antagonistic towards the book?
Well, most of them were ministers that were collecting this information.
I mean, I'm talking about the citizens, right? The citizens themselves, to who actually signed the affidavits, right? Right. What reason does Matilda Spaulding have, or Matilda Davison have, to fabricate?
Well, and Solomon was a minister, and you know, they're religious people, but
I think they're honestly mistaken.
They're honestly mistaken.
I want to hone in on this, Dan, very briefly. Do you dispute that there was no second manuscript?
Right.
What manuscript was left at the printing office then?
The one that we have that was returned according to the widow.
Do you think that manuscript matches the data that we have that claims that the manuscript was essentially ready for production and was waiting on a preface some financing in order to print it, and Spalding died before he financed it and had the preface written?
Well, there some people explain about the finances. Other people just say it wasn't finished.
Is Bryce, are you getting to the idea that a finished manuscript in theory left at the printing office is different from the one that was found that cuts off mid-story?
Well, that's kind of one of the integral pieces of the Spalding theory altogether, is that manuscript story Conneaut Creek is not manuscript found. These are two separate texts. Manuscript story Conneaut Creek is a rough draft. It is a beginning. No. It is an idea, concept.
It's not a rough draft. It's not a rough draft at all.
Manuscript
It's a finished text.
Okay,
it's Dan, let's quit. Dan? It doesn't finish the last chapter.
No, I'm sorry. Dan, you have clearly extensively read it. Indian Origins, you quoted a bunch. I mean, there's huge chunks that are cut. There are chunks of sentences that are missing. There are huge strike throughs. Conneaut Creek is
most
not
of those
only
are
it
rewrites.
Run, it's
most of
awful.
Those are rewrites.
So a lot of them are rewrites, but it is not in a it's not a printer's manuscript though.
Hey Dan, let me ask you this.
No, but he wanted the printer to see if he could he was willing to publish it. And so he left it before he finished it. That's everybody says it wasn't finished. It was the manuscript given to the printer was not finished. The printer said finish it in some of the testimonies.
Right.
Other testimonies that are a lot later by Rhetoric, I believe you're referring to. These guys don't know what they're talking about.
Rhetoric McKee. Right. But I'm fairly certain that a number of these witnesses say that the manuscript was waiting on a preface and funding.
That was
in order
one,
to print
one
it.
Account was that was
and
one
wasn't,
thing.
Wasn't one of the accounts from one of the printers or one of the people associated with the print shop who said that there was a manuscript that was waiting for publication that was not completed?
The printer gave it back. They weren't waiting for a preface. The printer, according to the widow, the printer gave the manuscript back and she put it in the trunk. And my next statement, my next little exploratory thing is to talk about the widow and that trunk, because that trunk, and they say the manuscript in the trunk has the names of Lehi and Nephi, and the one in the trunk is the one we have, and it doesn't have those names.
So let me just jump in real quick. Isn't it my understanding is that the trunk that was found in Hawaii is claimed to have belonged
I know, but
I think this is important.
It comes out of that trunk.
When manuscript story is found in Hawaii in a trunk, that trunk is claimed to have belonged to somebody connected to the family of the Pittsburgh print shop.
No.
That's not true?
No.
That trunk belonged to Spalding's family.
The hair cover trunk belonged to Spalding's family. That it had a bunch of Spalding's writings in it, multiple manuscripts in it. Hurlbut went to discover it with a letter from Matilda to go to his brother-in-law's or her brother-in-law's in order a certificate saying, hey, go ahead and let him look in the trunk. Right. Yeah. And Hurlbut went and looked in the trunk.
At his niece's house.
Niece's house. Thank you. But so Hurlbut goes, looks in the trunk. He recovers manuscript story. And an integral piece of the Spalding theory is that, yes, manuscript story Conneaut Creek exists. Yes, that is what Hurlbut acquired from that chest. And that the second draft of manuscript story Conneaut Creek is manuscript found that was actually waiting at the printers.
Well, the distinction of the title is kind of artificial because there is no title on it.
So the Conneaut, title on manuscript story Conneaut Creek. That's
written in pencil. No,
that's in Spaulding's handwriting.
No,
and Hurlbut even attests it when he collects it. He even attests. He writes down collected this manuscript story in present form as it came to
me. It was not on the it was not on the manuscript. It was on the wrapper. In light pencil.
In Solomon Spaulding's handwriting.
Well, you showed the picture of it, and that's not the title of the book. The book has no title. This was just something that was jotted on in pencil, not ink, on a buff papered wrapper. That it was, and it was tied together with some other manuscripts, but it was written there, and it's not the title of the book.
It's manuscript story Conneaut Creek is on the cover of it.
Okay,
the written in the author's handwriting. I don't know how that doesn't
that was a
and
piece
more and importantly too, cover,
according to Rice.
But importantly as well, numerous of the witnesses who were that Hurlbut collected from said that it was titled Manuscript.
It could have been.
Right. Manuscript Story Conneaut Creek. Not only does it not fit the bill of all of those witness statements, which is explained by
they're
false
all
memory,
mistaken.
Right? Of course. Right. Okay. So all these
20-year-old memories. Right. 20-year-old memories.
So this is, I think this is a foundational part of point of disagreement, is that once the manuscript story Conneaut Creek was published, rediscovered, and it was published under the title Manuscript Found, that it was very effective at putting the idea out there and getting the idea circulated that this was the only manuscript that Spaulding ever wrote. And that this is what the manuscript that the theory alleges is the source text for the book.
The second manuscript was invented when it was discovered that the manuscript in the trunk didn't match the Book of Mormon. How do they rationalize their memories, which they believe?
I mean,
and against the physical evidence that contradicts their memories. Well, they invent the second manuscript.
They clearly title the individuals who testify clearly title it Manuscript Found.
They say repeatedly. Yeah, it could have been. I'm telling you,
but the Spaulding text is titled by Spaulding.
No, it's not
Manuscript
titled.
Story Conneaut Creek, and it exists.
But even if it's not,
I just explained that.
It's
in Ohio. You should read L.L. Rice's description of how he found the manuscript and how it was wrapped in paper. And on that paper was written this. Well, that paper still stuck with the manuscript, but it's not the title page of the manuscript. You can look, you showed the picture. Look at the picture that you had showed us earlier. It's not the title of a book. It has other little things on it. It's written in pencil. You know, it's different than the whole manuscript.
I think I get both of your positions on this. Bryce, can I ask you a question that I'm a little bit confused on? Mm-hmm. Because I had thought that this manuscript, the one that we're talking about, the only one that exists that we know of right now, right?
Yes.
I had thought that was found like in 1880 in Honolulu.
Yeah. Yes.
And yet you're talking about Hurlbut.
That's being what he
involved
discovered.
In getting it out of a hairy chest.
Yes.
Hairy trunk.
Hair-covered trunk. Yes. Yeah. So he collected it. That's when he grabbed that. He took that manuscript back with him, showed it to some of the individuals.
This is 1833.
34. 34. Late 33. Or was it 34? I can't remember. It was the turn of the year that he was collecting affidavits and making all of his
I think it was November 33 you went back and showed people the manuscript.
And yeah, where did
Aaron
he get it
Wright
from?
Is one of them.
He got it from a relative of Spaulding, from Matilda's niece, right? Matilda.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he actually has a manuscript that's represented as being written by Solomon Spaulding that he goes back and shows to the witnesses.
Yes. And numerous of those, two of the witnesses say this is not the manuscript found. Right. And importantly as well, the daughter of Spaulding, Matilda McKinstry, once the manuscript story Conneaut Creek was published as manuscript found by both the RLDS and the LDS Church, she read it and very specifically said, I think she wrote it in a letter. It was to one of the expose artists at the time. I can't remember if it was Tucker or A.B. Deming, or if it was Wilhelm Weyemetal. In any case, she says, do the Mormons think that they can trick us by saying that this is manuscript found? This is not my father's manuscript found. Very specifically, okay. She says, this is not the text that my father wrote as manuscript found that was used for the Book of Mormon.
Did she recognize it as a separate manuscript that her father had authored?
Oh, I can't. The nuances of that account, I can't remember.
Repeat that question.
Did she identify it as a separate manuscript that her father had authored?
Manuscript story. No. I'm pretty sure she said, I recognize it as my father's handwriting.
I could get my...
I mean, once again, we get lost in the weeds, right? But I think it's important to know.
Be very, that, very pertinent because
I think I can answer that for you.
Who knows what her father's manuscript was like?
Yeah, and I can answer that for you.
So presumably, she might know about the different manuscripts that her father had written. And I could see her saying, on the one hand, do the Mormons think they can trick us? This is not my father's manuscript found. Yeah. It's a different manuscript that my father wrote.
They accused Herba of writing that title on it just to cover it up.
Well, I'm just saying that if this daughter just says blanketly, no, my dad didn't write this, then, I mean, are we sure that this manuscript shown to the witnesses by Herba is the same manuscript that was found in 1880 in Honolulu?
Herba turned over his papers, including this, to E.D. Howe. And E.D. Howe ran the Painesville Telegraph newspaper. And when he had to sell that, it ended up in L.L. Rice's possession. And he was in Honolulu at one point with the trunk. So then this manuscript he gave, I think it went directly from him to Oberlin College in Northern Ohio.
Yes.
And that's where it is right now.
Okay.
Solomon Spaulding's handwriting.
I think it may be significant. And you guys are the experts on the materials and everything.
I found this is Matilda McKinstry's 1880 statement. She said, I perfectly remember the appearance of the trunk and of looking at its context and contents. There were sermons and other papers. I saw a manuscript about an inch thick, closely written, tied with some of the stories my father had written for me, one which he called The Frogs of Windham, which is, another pre-existing text, right? On the outside of the manuscript were written words, manuscript found. And she says, I did not read it, but looked through it and had it in my hands many times and saw the names that I heard at Conneaut when my father read it to his friends. She says, I was about 11 years at the time.
Are you missing the implications of that statement?
So she is identifying the 1880 manuscript that was found in Hawaii as being the same one that was shown to her by Hurlbut.
Yes. In the trunk.
Yes.
And with the title. What's wrong with her memory? She's having the same problem as everyone else.
Well, that's the foundation of all of
her. Her and her mother is talking about. They are talking about the manuscript in the trunk. So we have a chance to test their memories.
Okay, all right. So
my last point, which is exactly this, Bryce. You're reading my last part.
Well, and I do have the exact quote where, she says, she says, I have read much of the manuscript story Conneaut Creek, which you have sent me. She sent this in a letter to A.B. Deming, Naked Truths About Mormonism, in an 1886 letter. And she says, I know that it is not the manuscript found which contained the words Nephi, Mormon, Moroni, and Lamanites. Do the Mormons expect to deceive the public by leaving off the title page, Conneaut Creek, and calling it manuscript found and manuscript story? So very, very explicitly, says, this is not manuscript found. This is manuscript story. The Mormons are trying to deceive us right now.
Yeah, but the answer is right there. It's not saying what you think it's saying at all.
Well, we're way down this rabbit hole. Please,
let me get to my last part, and then we'll revisit.
Is that where we are? I forgot where we are, Bill. Are we on Dan again?
Yeah,
I think so. Bryce started off the whole.
This is my last point, anyway.
You have any objection, Bryce?
No, that's great.
Okay, here we go. I'll start it again.
All right, so let's read the. I'll go to the next one. I'm going to skip Matilda Davison. They both, the daughter and mother, have the same name, so it's a little confusing.
Matilda Junior.
Yeah. So this is questions asked in 1839 of Matilda Spalding McKinstry, the daughter. Question, okay, to Mrs. McKinstry, how old was you when your father wrote the manuscript? About 5 years old. Did you ever read the manuscript? When I was about 12 years old, I used to read it for diversion, which is about the year 1819. Did the manuscript describe an idolatrous or a religious people? Answer, an idolatrous people, which matches the Kaniya manuscript. Does the manuscript and the Book of Mormon agree? I think some of the names agree. Are you certain that some of the names agree? I am not. Have you ever read in the Book of Mormon? I have not. And this is the Quincy Whig, 16th of November. I think it's the year 1839, but it's quoted in the Times and Seasons in January 1840. So next slide, we get to what Bryce was reading here. Matilda Spalding McKinstry, daughter, testifies about the manuscript in the trunk in 1880, 41 years after the previous one in the Times and Seasons.
And this is the same person.
This is the same person. Okay. This is, and this is what I mean, like over time, their memories get better. Okay. But she first describes what happens when she's five. Afterward, he read the manuscript, which I had seen him writing to the neighbors and to a clergyman, a friend of his who came to see him. Some of the names that he mentioned while reading to these people, I have never forgotten. They are as fresh to me today as though I heard them yesterday. They were Mormon, Moroni, Lamanite, Nephi. Then she describes the manuscript in the trunk after her father died, which she examined when she was 11 or 12. I perfectly remember the appearance of this trunk. I'm going to reread it. And looking at its contents, on the one side, on the outside of the manuscript were written the words manuscript found. I did not read it, but looked through it and had it in my hands many times. And I saw the names I had heard in Kaniya when my father read it to his friends. I was about 11 years of age. So I would suggest that the Spalding's daughter is a test case for how the public discussion can contaminate memory.
Yeah, you're showing that there are significant differences between her testimony in 1839 versus her testimony in 1880.
And that happens with a lot of these witnesses.
Yeah.
That you can find that before they didn't know something, but years later when they're interviewed, they know things that contradict what they said 10 or more years earlier. And this is an exact, this, all these other witnesses can say, oh, you know, that's not the manuscript. And, you know, and so we have to rely on their memories. This whole thing relies on people's memories and nothing else. Okay. There is nothing.
Disagree.
And those computer studies don't mean anything. Here we have the people describing the trunk and the manuscripts in the trunk. And we know what we have the manuscript.
We got a minute there, Dan.
So the story, Spalding's story is so similar to the Book of Mormon. 20 years later, you're going to get these two stories confused, especially like Nehemiah King only hearing, you know, vague outline and making these abrupt conclusions about there's only one person that could write this down, and that was Spalding. And so, and then it's that was a suggestion by Nehemiah King, was a judge and well respected. And that was a suggestion to other people. And people started talking about it for a year. And then other people started saying, oh, yeah, I think that. And just like the memory studies I was describing, this is a perfect example of how it works. And if I had time, I could give you examples of some false stories that spread through our culture right now.
Okay, time. And now Bryce is going to have 5 minutes to respond. I know that he was taking some exception with something about memories is all we have, but use your time as you wish, Bryce.
Yeah, I'll actually just use this as my final point, because I know we probably have a little bit of wrapping up to do after this. But yeah, I'll just present my final point. We can kind of discuss after that. So let's talk about conspiracy, right? So next slide, please. When we're talking about the organic evolution of the conspiracy, let's just grant that Spalding theory is true, that Sidney Rigdon purloined a manuscript from a dead Reverend Revolutionary War vet, that he gave it to Joseph Smith, that the two of them collaborated. Let's just grant the Spalding theory, right? What would we expect to see the sequence of events if it were actually true? I think we would see probably a slow realization of the public as individuals begin to hear about what's going on. Then we would immediately hear charges of conspiracy. Then we would eventually find an author of the source text discovered this, that they had been plagiarized. But in this case, the author was dead. So then it is left up to the person's associates and family, their next of kin, in order to bring out allegations that this was a stolen text, right? That would immediately precipitate a series of fact-finding, which we see in the case of Ebert E. Howe forming the fact-finding committee for the research into Mormonism Unveiled, and hiring Hurlbut to go out there and collect all the affidavits, try and find a copy of the manuscript, so on and so forth, a series of fact-finding and discovery. We'd also expect prior to that, members of the church itself eventually becoming wise to this and starting to ask some tough questions. And we would also expect if there was documentary proof that this had been plagiarized, we would expect legal action to be taken. Or we would expect, if there wasn't proof, that this would be something that could only really be aired out in the court of public opinion, right? And if we, you know, once it is aired out or whatever, there would be the resolution of the criminal activity, right? During all of these steps, we would also expect to see institutional damage control and backlash. And I would argue that what Philaster Hurlbut experienced, regardless of his personality, he was clearly a bit of a scoundrel. He was a womanizer. He was not a great guy. But regardless of his personality, I argue that what he experienced is consistent with the conduct of the church if it were indeed trying to hide the Spalding authorship theory. And that is, first, to slander him out in public through a system of excommunication, the vague charges of excommunication, and then go on a public character assassination spree. Eventually, this catalyzes in Joseph Smith and Dr. Hurlbut getting into some kind of an altercation, and Hurlbut being arrested for this. In all of this, of course, there's so much more to go into all of this, right? But I just use this as a point to argue that if Spalding theory is true, this sequence of events of we see of the individuals discovering the conspiracy follows the exact sequence of events as they happened. And I don't know what sequence of events we would expect to see differently, given a sole authorship theory, if the Spalding theory is not true. Next slide, please. And I think what's important too is that there are early allegations of criminal conspiracy. We have in September of 1829, we have the Palmyra Reflector alleging criminal conspiracy between Martin Harris, Joseph Smith, and Oliver Cowdery. We have the Painesville Telegraph alleging criminal behavior by Parley Pratt. And that he was actually fleeing constables when he was given his preaching license in 1829 and departed for New York. And then we immediately have allegations of Rigdon having some kind of hand in the criminal conspiracy in November of 1830, and then first connected with Joseph Smith in February of 1831. And those are just the very, very first allegations that we have of the of people saying that there is a criminal conspiracy here. It was a couple of years after this that it was discovered the source text, of course, that Solomon Spaulding's next of kin were made aware that that he was potentially the author for the source text. Next slide, please. So I think there are some unanswered questions in all of this. And I think maybe if we can maybe try and come back to these. Well, this is my presentation time, right? So why did Rigdon lie in his 1839 rebuttal? Y'all discussed that very extensively. There's some real interesting questions there. Why was Joseph Smith silent on this matter his entire life in public discourse, in speaking publicly about the allegations specifically? What was Hurlbut's real reason for excommunication? Because the meeting minutes are from the Kirtland High Council meeting minutes, they are missing. We have the explanation of spontaneous utterances. We got into that a little bit. Then we have what more evidence is needed to finally conclude that the Spaulding theory is true. I think that is very kind of a provocative question. I see you're trying to stop me, RFM. So I think just analyzing the profiles of all of the potential authors, we have Joseph Smith, who is basically unlearned, and then we have two reverends and who have pre-existing writings that are all consistent with the Book of Mormon, and who are, one of them is trying to start his own religion with his own message in the very competitive sphere of religion at the time. And I just think that if we're looking at those individuals alone, just the profiles of Spaulding and Rigdon or Joseph Smith, that Spaulding and Rigdon obviously are far more likely than Joseph Smith.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And yeah, I was giving you a little bit extra time, but that's sort of to try and balance off. There was a little bit more time that was going to Dan in non, you know, scripted 5-minute segments. So I think that you both had pretty much an equal opportunity time-wise to argue your positions. And, you know, this has been fascinating to me. I know that I was a bit concerned that this was sort of just going to be, you know, part three, and this is going to be everything we talked about before said by two other people. This has been much more interesting to me than I anticipated, and I've learned more than I anticipated from both of you, so I thank you both very much. Bill, this is your show. I'm sounding like I'm in charge. I apologize.
No, I want to just say thank you to both of you. I'm actually trying to grab the call-in studio, so I'm going to put the banner up if folks do want to call in really quick.
Right, call the call-in show. The number here is 662-667-6667 or 662 Mormons with an S.
Yeah, I very much appreciate both somebody? Of you. I'm hoping so in another 30 seconds or so. Okay. But let me just say, you both are very passionate about parts of this. And I think in places you're sort of debating some of the stuff that's sort of off in the weeds. And I think to some extent, I think you both agree. And I think Bryce would acknowledge that this theory really does need something else to sort of put it over the edge. It's sort of lacking something. And Dan, I don't think Bryce disagrees with you on faulty memory, but I found several things interesting. You know, Bryce, the pamphlet put together by Walter Scott with a connection to Sidney Rigdon, I think that's interesting. I think there's things certainly to consider here that at least add some more value to the two parts that we already did. And I do want to, before we go to the phone calls, can I ask the two of you, do you feel like we covered the most important evidence in the theory? And do you think we were fair and balanced in the way that we did so?
I think that I'm glad that Dan worked with y'all putting the show notes together, because I kind of agree with Dan's assessment that what you presented on the first two parts is kind of the distilled best evidence that we have available to us. And, you know, at the end of that, obviously, if we're coming up still lacking at that point, then we need more evidence, or we need to kind of say that this is just a fringe theory that can just kind of live there and so be it. And other scholars and consensus of Mormon historians will continue on their pursuit. And that is all to say that, like, it's provocative. It's super interesting. Yeah. And I think it's valuable, even if it just teaches us a lot about early Mormon history. But I also had never really considered Dan's overall perspective. And it really resonates with me that the Spaulding theory dominated the 19th century. That much is just fact. and how much scholarship was not done, how much research was not done at that time, while people around the Smiths, the people who were still alive at the time, could have been interviewed, and they weren't because people were chasing more Spalding interviews, or they were chasing the next Spalding piece. That has represented a massive disservice to the field of academic history, Mormon history specifically. And I had never considered that kind of a cost benefit analysis to all of it. I have viewed it as kind of a kitschy and fun and unique way to look at Mormon history without analyzing the cost. And that kind of persuades me a bit. That hurts. Yeah. How much was never documented because people were just chasing the meme of Spalding? I don't know.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, Dan, one of the things I've heard Bryce say in a different conversation that's out there is that Bryce acknowledges that this theory has flaws to it, but that it's a better explanation for the Book of Mormon in the founding of Mormonism than gold plates in a box seen by, given by an angel in a hill, translated by a rock and a hat, by the gift and power of God. Would you go so far to acknowledge that the Spalding-Rigdon theory is more reasonable and rational than the faithful Mormon narrative told in the missionary discussions?
Well, that seems like a loaded question in a way, because it's kind of a false dichotomy in my mind to say this wrong thing is better than this other wrong thing.
Could you just answer the question, Dan?
There's our prosecutor.
So, to me, it's just a bizarre theory, a waste of time. And
the angel in the gold plates or the Spalding-Rigdon theory?
The Spalding-Rigdon theory. a waste of time, diversion. It diverted us. I reread the Spalding manuscript to get ready for this, because I hadn't read it since 2012. But and I was struck by how much Spalding's manuscript is so much better than the Book of Mormon in certain ways, because it's written by a mature man who's experienced life. He was in the Revolutionary War. It's much more realistic as a history of ancient America than the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon's more written. It's like taking the Mound Builder myth and writing from a theological point of view, the Book of Mormon. Spalding is more like writing from a secular view. More realistic, with little tribes fighting each other. He describes them in vast detail that the Book of Mormon never even gets close to, So, and Spalding had a wild imagination. I mean, the guy wrote out scenarios about the war. He made this love triangle, and this is why the two tribes were fighting each other over a princess, and it was quite elaborate and far more interesting than the Book of Mormon.
Yeah. I mean, it's a retelling of Helen of Troy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
it sounded that way to me.
There you go.
Very much is. Yeah.
All right, we've got one caller. Let's take the caller. I don't mean to be dismissive at all. I just know we're at 8:17, and I want to take the call. And we'll put Spalding and Rigdon to bed and never revisit this ever again
for another decade at least.
Yeah. No, probably longer than that.
There is one matter I wanted to mention, though, about the Joseph Smith's silence. He never responded to any of the criticisms, never to the money digging, never to his in-laws, never to anybody. All he did is call them names.
He did call a lot of names, but after Missouri Mormon War, he had no problem calling things lies, calling things falsehoods, and things that were factually accurate. So
that's what he did, but he never responded to any.
But I mean, that is
really
in
E.D. Howe's book. In E.D. Howe's book, he never really responded to any of that stuff. He just
Dan, did he not say at one point when he was giving
it was
answers.
A bunch of lies. He did call it a bunch of lies, but he never got down to this is what the details of why things were wrong. He never did, because he couldn't.
He did say, though, at one point that in responding to frequently asked questions, that he did admit to having been a money digger when he was younger, but he gave it up because it didn't pay very well.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that wasn't an honest answer to anything.
No.
That was just, you know, that was a lie itself. He called them liars and while he was lying.
just so I get this right, are you saying then that you think the angel with gold plates and a hill translated by a rock and a hat is more reasonable?
In that culture, yes.
In theory.
In that culture, it made perfect sense. It was so believable that the money diggers thought he actually had plates and they were trying to steal them.
No, we're not talking about in that culture. We're talking about models of history.
Yeah.
Models that explain historical events. Historical models.
Okay, so no, of course, that's not real. But the Spalding story is just as unreal, but not in a supernatural way.
Okay.
So how can you compare an unreal story, unbelievable story?
I mean,
supposedly happened in history, and one that was supernatural. Why are you doing that?
One requires God of the universe to interfere with our to exist to begin with, and to interfere with our and to have chosen Joseph and all of the steps that get us to Joseph Smith wrote it. One requires all of those, whereas the other one requires a theoretical manuscript.
And we would have to admit that
it's not very sound historically.
Yeah, and I get that, but we have to classify the Spalding theory as believable, even if it's only insofar as the fact that others have believed it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
How's Mormonism unbelievable? Right? Mormonism is also believable.
Right.
There's nothing in the world that's unbelievable at this point.
Yeah.
I'll go
with the From a historian's point of view.
All right.
Theories are not generally, applauded to explain things. Historians generally don't appeal to conspiracy theories to explain various things about history. And if they do, it's like you're looked upon with great skepticism.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. We've got one caller, and I'm actually going to turn off the call bank, but there's just one caller. We'll take that one. We'll end the show and we'll call it a night. So let me check your caller. Are you there? Oop, give me a second to try to put you onto that device. Give me just a moment.
We'll call it a night, or we'll call it the manuscript
found. Okay, give me 1 second, caller. Yeah. Okay. Caller, you've got a question for Bryce?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Not that I agree with the Spalding Rigdon theory, but it's definitely, you know, has its interesting aspects to it. It's pretty easy to connect potentially Spalding and Rigdon to each other, both having been in Philadelphia around the same time. But to me, whether or not this whole thing makes any sense hinges on, is there anything to suggest that Rigdon met Joseph Smith prior to 1830? And from what I have so far, I don't know of anything. And you've done a great job arguing for the theory. I'm just wondering if there's anything that you have that would possibly connect them, or is it just, well, they could have ridden by night and not been caught?
Yeah,
so that's a great question. Can we throw it to Bryce first?
Yeah. So very briefly, if that information existed, it would be one of the primary smoking guns of the Spalding theory. And because the Spalding theory does not have that, it is obviously that there are later reminiscences of people who put Sidney Rigdon in Palmyra, in Manchester area. There are accounts, if we're talking about Obadiah Dogberry, right? He's clearly referring to Lumen Walters. Another potential expose may have been referring to, or another, sorry, potential journal may have been referring to Sidney Rigdon, but the person is not named. We have Rangdon, that Rangdon from James Gordon Bennett, who has a really complicated history with Mormonism as well. And, you know, that's a pre-1830 connection. We have just a couple of people whispering about it. Nothing hard documentary evidence. However, we do have multiple blocks of time of Joseph Smith's calendar and Sidney Rigdon's calendar, where there are blocks that are empty together that coincide, that they easily could have arranged a meeting. But of course, that requires that the conspiracy theory is true. And, you know, then we get into, well, Joseph Smith moved to Harmony because all of the Palmyra treasure diggers knew about the Spaulding theory, and they were trying to get a hold of the manuscript so that they could publish it instead of Joseph publishing it. So Joseph moved to Harmony because it was closer to Kirtland, where Sidney Rigdon was, and he could work together with Rigdon in peace. And, you know, once again, it's the as Dan has talked about, the ballooning effect of the conspiracy theory just makes it a very heavy conspiracy. I don't know that it can stand on its own 2 feet without collapsing under itself.
Yeah, love that.
What do you think about that question, Dan?
So it was assumed that Joseph Smith wasn't smart enough to write the Book of Mormon, so they latched on to Sidney Rigdon as a possible author without any evidence whatsoever. And the 1831 James Gordon Bennett talking about Rangdon was based on a stranger that appeared at the Smith farm, especially in around 1827 when it was time to get the plates. And this, what I contend, is Joseph Knight Sr. And Josiah Stoll. Money, and they were money diggers. And this Rangdon was supposed to be a money. If this is Rigdon, this Rangdon is supposed to be a money digger. And nobody ever talked about Rigdon coming to Palmyra to dig for treasure. But Joseph Knight Sr. and Josiah Stoll both came right when Joseph Smith was getting the plates, and they were there. We know Lucy talks about it. Joseph Smith borrows Joseph Knight Sr.'s horse and wagon and goes to the hill. Well, so there was this thing around Palmyra about a stranger. Who was the stranger? Nobody knew who the stranger was. They couldn't get anyone to identify the stranger. Okay. When Pomeroy Tucker wrote his history in 1867 or 76, 76, 76, 67.
It's Origin Rise.
So Pomeroy Tucker said, no, none of the neighbors knew who the stranger was. And one of his advisors in writing his book was Lorenzo Saunders, who later says he knows who the stranger is, but after a lot of prodding. Okay. So nobody knows who the stranger is. John Gilbert, the guy that set the type for the Book of Mormon, he was approached by James Cobb, who was collecting documents on Mormon origins. James Cobb wanted Gilbert to find somebody who knows who the stranger is. And so Gilbert starts looking around for people. He can't find anybody. The closest he came was this Abel Chase, but Abel Chase wasn't sure. And the problem is that Rigdon does come. Rigdon does come to Palmyra and preaches on Main Street in 1830. And some people get that confused with 1827, years and years later. But so Gilbert approaches Lorenzo Saunders and tells him, if we could just nail down who the stranger was, we will have him the whole thing worked out. The evidence that we need. And Lorenzo Saunders says, well, you know, I think he was, but let me think about it. And he goes home and he thinks about it and he talks about it with others. And he finally concludes that it was Rigdon who was the stranger at the Smith farm, and that either he recognized him from 1830, or, as he claimed in some sources, that it was Samuel Smith told him it was Rigdon. Or it was Hiram that told him it was Rigdon. So anyway, this is exactly this memory conflation, confabulation, or whatever you want to call it, can happen just like this, where their memories, they get under pressure, they have to, they're thinking, they want evidence against Mormonism, and they come up with it. Okay. And that's, and so nobody can identify, get Joseph Smith and Signe Rigdon together. Well, Signe Rigdon did live near Pittsburgh, where the manuscript supposedly was, but the manuscript wasn't there. According to the widow, it was returned and put in the trunk, and they moved away in 1814. They moved away from that area. So there was no manuscript to steal. They had put it in the trunk. And
can I go rehash my whole presentation too, real quick? Is that cool?
All right.
Well, it's because he took it, he copied it. It took it down to the king.
No, okay. So that's another aspect,
right? Is that what he did?
So the widow knows that the manuscript has been returned. So her explanation is that Rigdon must have copied it and put it back. Yeah. And so that's her rationalization to try to figure out. And humans do this. They take, if there's like gaps in their memory, your memory will fill it in. Okay. You will make sense of it. There's that, it's called the cognitive imperative.
So
very nice. I like that.
Yeah.
And we're going to give the last half hour to Bryce so he can recapitulate his entire argument. No, I kid, because I don't think that's what you were doing, but it was fascinating. Bryce, you take some time here. You say whatever else you want to say.
Yeah. So I think there's so much more, right? Like there's so much more that Dan and I could sit here and discuss, that all the four of us could discuss. We could get lost in the weeds for another couple hours just down on one of these accounts, right? So, yeah. But that's what's kind of fun about this, right? So that's like why you go to Sunstone and JWHA and MHA, and like you go to presentations and you read these books and you read books from researchers like this individual who we have here, right? Like it's fun, it's interesting, and I think my overall takeaway from it is that the Book of Mormon occupies a space of special pleading for a lot of individuals, right? The vast, vast, vast majority of people who have ever read the Book of Mormon or who have ever written about it, researched it, who have done any critical analysis of it, have all been coming from an affirming faith perspective that has foundationally hampered and hamstrung their analysis and their ability to evaluate the text critically as a naturalistic text, right? And I think that if we see all of the evidence for the Spalding authorship theory for the Book of Mormon, if we saw this amount of evidence for any other book from antiquity from the time, if there was this much evidence for Ethan Smith's view of the Hebrews as a fun little analog to this, right? That I think a lot of people would have no problem immediately coming to the conclusion, oh, well, Ethan Smith just plagiarized a book, right? That they see all of these witness statements that are pretty soon after the events that happen, that are immediately responding to, you know, learning that this plagiarism possibly happened. We see all of these events transpire. That most people would easily conclude. However, because the Book of Mormon requires a faith proposition component to it, I think it is granted a case of special pleading that it does not deserve. Because at the end of the day, it is a piece of literature. It is a text that we need to read just like any other text, and it should be treated just like any other text. And historians working with theoretical or working on historical models that require theoretical texts is something that Bible scholars do all day, every day, right? So this is not something that is a problem for historians. It just means that it needs to be dealt with more carefully and with more scrutiny when a theoretical manuscript is relied upon for a theory to work, right? So that is all to say that there's a lot more we could dig into. There's a lot more to the Spalding theory as a whole. But I do have one final soapbox that I want to jump on that's related to a couple of things I've said here. Support research, folks, right? Looking at me, right? Support research, right? Dan Vogel I have a career because of Dan Vogel and the researchers who have built the entire field of Mormon history academia. And like, Dan is a member of a vanishing minority of people, and that is independent Mormon history researchers. And they gotta be supported. I can't imagine what Dan could do with what he could have done through his entire career if he didn't have to work a day job during all of the time that he's doing this research and everything, right? So that's just my earnest plea to, like, get out there and support research, get out there and support content creators, because, like, this is a labor of love for so many individuals who engage into this space, and, like, so much good comes from this, right? Like, look, Naked Mormonism, my career wouldn't be a thing without these. These were my Bibles for Naked Mormonism, right? That and early Mormonism, or the early Mormon documents, right?
Can I ask what it was that you were holding up there?
What was that? What was that?
It was very blurry. That's a Source and Text Critical Edition of the History of the Church.
By who?
By Dan Vogel.
Right? So, like, these, this.
Those are free stuff, online, by the way.
It's
bad sales tactic.
At archive.org, and they're searchable.
Oh my God.
That would have been a lot cheaper than
eight volumes. A critical addition to the history of the church. So,
but I don't want the plea to be lost here. This is my soapbox, and I want listeners, look, I like you listening and watching right now. You might think it's the other person, or hey, someone else will come along and do it, right? And, like, you know, Mormon Discussions just lost, you know, one of their big donors as well. So, like, support research, support content creators, support things that you see value in, because without that support, those things never exist to begin with. And, you know, that's a massive tragedy that kind of ties together a lot of the things that we've discussed tonight. So that's my soapbox.
And a wonderful point on which I think we can all agree.
Yeah, love it. Thank you to both of you. Listeners, I hope that you enjoyed this. I know that I did. You guys created quite a vibrant conversation. Folks, part one, part two, here's part three. And starting next week, we will move on to other things. But it has been a lot of fun for me to really get a handle on why so many people see some weight in the Rigdon Spalding theory. And I hope you enjoyed kind of exploring that with us. Thank you, Dan Vogel. Thank you, Bryce Blankenagel. Thank you to both of you for all the time that you put into Mormon history. And folks, thank you for listening and watching and following along on Mormonism Live. We'll see you next week. And can't wait to see what we do then. Have a great day.
Thanks, everybody.